The Brian D. O'Leary Show, your home for serious content amidst an unserious culture. All right, welcome back to The Brian D. O'Leary Show. Today I have with me Matthew Cercely. And Matthew's been a licensed attorney since 2009, and in 2020, he founded his own company to provide tax advice and planning for small businesses. He said he's dedicated to helping entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, and side hustlers by setting up their businesses to legally avoid as much tax as possible. And he exclusively works with those who have or are starting businesses. And even if you're not one of those folks, Matthew has a weekly newsletter that offers general advice that he says anyone can use. And when he's not screwing around with the government, Matthew enjoys camping, weightlifting, and gaming. So, Matthew, welcome to the program. Good to have you on.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So, you're an attorney, and in this scope, well, you're an attorney, and you started getting into the tax advice. You're not a tax attorney per se. Is that correct?
Right. So most people, when they talk about a tax attorney, like that's somebody who's, you're suing the IRS or you've been charged by the IRS. I don't do any of that. I can, but that's not what I want to be doing.
Right.
What I do is tax advice and tax planning. I help people do things now so that when they pay their taxes next year, 2 years, 5 years, they owe less money following the government's own rules.
Got it. And you started this in around 2020, you said, and before that, and even currently, you're a personal injury attorney, and that's your kind of bread and butter, if I'm...
That's correct, yeah. I'm a working litigation attorney, doing a lot of work on car wrecks, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But kind of part of how I got into the tax stuff was I kind of became the tax guy in the firm doing that, helping people with tax questions regarding... settlements and that sort of thing. And then I also had my own real estate business and I wanted to make sure I was not overpaying taxes there. So I started to learn more about taxes for that.
Right. And I think a lot of people know, and I've heard you on a couple other podcasts and you say real estate is a good way or a good vehicle to do this legally and above board, right? In many cases.
If you can meet all the requirements to become a quote, professional real estate investor, unquote, or a real estate professional, it's probably the most tax advantage way to make money out there. Mm. I mean, it's quite possible to legally have an income of several hundred thousand dollars and owe no income taxes. And there'll be tax maybe eventually, but I mean, for years and years and years, you can put it off.
Right. It's such things like 1031 exchange. It's not like you don't owe the tax. It just keeps you kicking the ball down the road or however that goes.
Exactly. And even then, if you die and you've never sold the properties, your family inherits it and they don't owe any of the taxes either.
Right. Okay.
They do just go away.
Yeah. So, yeah. And in your business as a, well, shall we call it tax planner, it's Agorist. I want to get this straight. It's agoristtaxadvice.com and we'll send you there at the end of the show. Explain Agorist to me or to the folks.
So Agorist, or some people call it Agorist.
Yeah.
It refers to the Greek word agora, which is the market. So agorists are very similar to libertarians in many ways, and many people are both. It's basically I'm just going to go out and I'm going to do business and I'm going to work legally when I have to, but if I've got to go into the gray market or the black market, I don't mind doing that. They're all markets. And, you know, I'm going to let the business kind of do what it's going to do. So it's kind of I kind of think of it, whereas most libertarians are more interested in politics.
Yeah.
Agorists are mostly kind of like, screw politics. I can't do anything there anyway. Then we just do business.
But there is a Venn diagram of sorts, whether it's libertarians, agorists, anarchists. There's some Venn diagram of all our people here that we can reach. So it's interesting. I saw you went to University of Dallas, and I went to Boston College, and both Catholic schools. And when I went to Boston College, the first, we were one of the first schools to have internet literally plugged in to our dorm room. And this was a huge, huge thing at that time. It was mid-90s, late 90s. And the program that BC had was called Agora, or Agora, or however, and people didn't know how to pronounce it, but I learned that it's the marketplace. And then I start getting in these libertarian type circles, and it takes on a different meaning when you're talking about an agorist versus agora, the whole market of, you know, getting internet, which was huge, never seen before in my time, and cable TV and a phone line all in one little fancy thing. So it's interesting to see how knowing that term, it being used in a really different manner, it's pretty neat to see. But so when you were in high school, I believe you had a boating accident that kind of moved you toward, not really in particular, but eventually kind of on the path to this personal injury stuff. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I was inner tubing, and that's a pretty common thing in Texas, where you get a motorboat and an inner tube and you tie a rope from one to the other, or sometimes you hold on like a water skiing, but usually it's tied on.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the boat goes and pulls you through the water on the inner tube, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the driver of the boat, who was actually one of my scoutmasters, was not really paying attention to what was going on in front of him and was about to hit somebody and managed to avoid them. But in doing so, I got swung to the side and I ended up hitting one of the wooden docks on the side of the lake. Mm. Broke both my legs, broke my jaw, spent a little over 6 weeks in the hospital. So yeah, that was a big part of why I became...
Sounds traumatic.
It was, and then additional things happened. At some point in the hospital, my lungs stopped working. So they put me into an induced coma for a couple of weeks. I literally had to learn how to walk again because I had and have some nerve damage in one of my legs from this. And also there was muscle atrophy.
Mm.
But honestly, like, I mean, it was a pretty miraculous recovery. Like, there were lots of doctors who are like, yeah, hopefully in a couple of years, he'll be able to walk without a cane or something. And I think about a year later, I was playing racquetball.
Wow.
The age definitely helped, you know, being 17, 18, you tend to bounce back a lot easier.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had to sue the driver of the boat to get his insurance to pay for my medical bills, which were well over $500,000. And didn't really, in hindsight, the attorney I had did a fine job. Mm-hmm. I don't want to badmouth him as a fellow professional, but I didn't like his style of communication and kind of felt like sometimes a lack of communication with me. And I just thought, as somebody who's really been through this, like, I'll understand what my personal injury clients are going through better than almost any other attorney out there.
Right.
Because even I know attorneys who have been injured, but they were attorneys when they got injured. So they didn't have the confusion about what to do. Like, again, I was literally a kid. I turned 18 in the hospital. So I had no idea how any of this worked. And just that understanding has really helped me professionally.
Yeah. And then the path wasn't direct, from what I understand. You become a math major. And you don't know what to do with a math major, right? There's limited things.
Yeah, my plan was to be a college professor.
Is that right? Okay.
At some point. See, it was only after I decided to become an attorney that I decided personal injury made sense.
Sure.
But no, I had lots of other plans. Was planning on being a teacher, and there are actually quite a few jobs for people who are good at math. Though, unfortunately, a lot of them end up working for the NSA, which wasn't really an option for me.
Yeah, stuff like that.
You know, actuaries make a lot of money.
Okay, yeah, you're right.
kind of boring, I think, but yeah. Actually, my next door neighbor growing up, he's an actuary, and he's doing pretty well for himself. Okay. So
good deal.
But no, I just, it was funny. Part of the issue was I couldn't get a research project to do in math. So I wasn't going to have a bachelor in science. Or I was going to have a bachelor in arts.
Okay.
And that was going to make it harder to get to a PhD or a good PhD program. And one of my good friends from high school was also a big math guy, also big into economics like I was at the time. And he basically mentioned an interesting fact to me, which is if you look at the entering class in most law schools, it's about 10% math and science people and about 90% humanities people.
Sure it is, yeah.
But when you look at the graduating class and like the top 10 or the top 20, it's usually 50-50.
Okay.
Like people in those math and hard sciences, they just tend to do really well in law school.
Solving problems and analyzing and all that jazz.
And some of it, you know, sometimes logic doesn't apply in the law, but mm-hmm. a lot of times it does apply. And when it does, you know, being able to not only understand something, but then logically explain it is a skill you learn as a mathematician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at Dallas, I think at one point there's a relatively heavy Austrian or at least Austrian influenced economics department. Because I didn't know about Austrian economics. I never heard of it until, gosh, close to 10 years after I graduated from college. Never heard of it. But it sounds like you were introduced possibly earlier on than, unfortunately.
Yeah, I was good friends with a guy named Adam Martin. He's now a professor at Texas Tech
okay.
in economics. But he was one of the first friends I made in college. And he definitely got me into the libertarian side of things and also the economic side of things. And yeah, when I was there, Samuel Bostaff was the head of the department at the time. And he was like a very much avowed Austrian economist.
Okay.
Then there were three other professors and two of them were at least very pro-free market
okay.
economists, even if they weren't 100% Austrian. And then the last one was a pretty standard economist, you know, not anti-Austrian, just not really into that type of thing.
Yeah.
But the thoughts and my change in philosophy from studying economics there.
Uh-huh.
And even though I was a math major, I took four or five economics classes just because I was always interested in it. Definitely was kind of formative in getting me to where I am today philosophically and also, again, career-wise.
Like, yeah.
Part of why I do what I do on the tax side is I want to screw with the IRS.
Right.
Like, that's just fun.
So it goes from kind of the Austrian school of economics or the thought or pro-free market into digging in more into the libertarian political philosophy and offshoots thereof. I would imagine. I mean, that's how I got to the point where I knew something was wrong. I didn't know what it was. I knew something was wrong. And I had to find the people that could provide at least good explanations, if not the answers. And it sounds like it kind of all dovetailed with you. You got your bread and butter personal injury practice. And then, you know, like, oh, gosh, guys need help with taxes? Like, I'm your man. Because I know all about that, and I know how I can help. That sounds like the brief story.
Yeah, I would actually say for me it was really more the philosophy of libertarianism
okay.
and the morality uh-huh. arguments that convinced me. And then, you know, it was kind of a happy accident that the economics backs it up.
Right.
But yeah, it was like the Adam Martin, like he just convinced me 100% on the morality of why is it okay for governments to do eminent domain? Like that was the actual discussion we were having
uh-huh.
was, you know, eminent domain and why it's immoral for governments to do eminent domain.
Yeah.
And kind of that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And after that, it's like, oh, we don't need governments to do this, man. And it's wrong for, they do so many things that are wrong and they violate our rights.
Yeah. I remember that was, I didn't know much about that. And, my mom's cousins, they have a farm in Tennessee, and there was a big thing like, oh, the government's going to take, or they're not going to take our property, they're going to take a bunch of our acres and split our farm in half essentially for a new freeway ripping through there. And then, like, how do we get from one part of the farm to the other? It's like okay, too bad, sorry, we're going to do this anyway, all the wheels are in motion. And they fought it. They couldn't really fight it too much. I mean, there's, you know, that famous case in New London, Connecticut, where my college roommate was from, one of my college roommates, and that put eminent domain on the forefront there, at least in libertarians. Yeah, in libertarian circles in particular, right?
Yeah, and this was what my discussion with my friend was actually while the Kelo case was ongoing,
okay,
before it had been decided.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, again, and any sort of theft by the government is theft. Like, it's not okay just because of the government. It's funny you mentioned that Tennessee. I've got, I don't want to say a friend, a person I know, and we like each other.
Right.
A guy named John Willis, who kind of lives in the middle of nowhere in Camden, Tennessee. But several of his neighbors, they've done eminent domain to take parts of their land to widen the road.
Sure.
And then 10 years later, there's no wider road, but the land is now the government's.
Yeah. Isn't that essentially what happened in New London, right? Like, they ended up not doing anything with the property, but they took it from her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but it's.
So can I put you on the spot here? You mentioned eminent domain, and we talk about taxation. Is taxation theft?
Taxation is absolutely theft. I don't believe the only moral argument I have to pay taxes is you can't do anything when you're in prison.
Right.
So I think taxation is theft. I don't think there should be taxes. But on the other hand, I don't agree with tax protesters who say I'm not going to pay taxes because I have a wife. I have a family. I have moral obligations to take care of them. And I can't do that from prison. So if I got to pay protection money to the mob to live my life, I'm going to do that. But if I can pay them less, I'm going to pay them as little as they'll take.
I was not necessarily doing research for this particular interview, but it comes up, you know, like my kids, I got the youngest ones are 4 and 6. And for some reason, they think thieves are the worst thing, right? Thieves. They got to beat up the thieves. And I was like, I look up one day in the kitchen, just look up, all right, what is what is the literal definition of a thief? And it's thievery is doing something somewhat clandestinely. A robber will just go and take your purse or take your wallet, like, and punch you and take your stuff. A thief does it when you're not looking, essentially. So I didn't quite put that together until probably last week. Like, when they say taxation is theft, it's not necessarily robbery, but it is theft to some degree, I guess. I mean, maybe we're getting too far down into the...
Well, and if you want to be technical, I think it's probably better to classify it as extortion.
Okay. I can live with
but
that.
But that just doesn't roll off the tongue quite as well.
Right.
So, you know, colloquially, theft, yeah, close enough.
Yeah, close enough. Yeah. All right. So, yeah, you've been on several podcasts. I first heard of you on the Tom Woods show, and I find out, you know, a few months ago that, oh, this guy is in the Tom Woods School of Life that I'm in. And I've been in it since the beginning, and now I have a bit bigger role. How'd you fall into Tom's orbit?
So it was back in the University of Dallas. Tom's book, The Church and the Market Economy, had just come out and was actually one of the books we were reading for one of my classes.
Oh, really?
So that was my first experience with Tom, was back in, what was that, 2002, 2001, okay. Something like that.
Early days.
And then was lucky enough to briefly meet him, not that he remembers this, but I went with my then girlfriend, my wife, down to Ron Paul's birthday party.
Okay.
Probably in, I don't know, 05 or 06, but he was giving a talk there before it. So we went, and that was, I mean, standing room only, and I'm sure if the fire marshal had walked in, they would have fined us for having that many people in that room. But so I did get to meet him and shake his hand again. He doesn't remember me because I was kind of a nobody at the time.
Sure.
But that's kind of where I first found Tom. So, and then the very first podcast I listened to was the Lou Rockwell Show.
Yeah.
And so somehow through that, I heard about Tom Woods. And I think I started listening at like the fourth episode of the show.
Okay.
And I've not listened to all of them, but I've probably listened to all but about 20 of them.
Okay. Yeah. And then you were on.
I've been part of Tom.
Yeah, you were on Tom's show. Was it about about a year ago. Is that
about a year and a half? I think it was July of last year.
Okay. Yeah.
And yeah, that was literally, in fact, it was a school of life and I was in the accountability group. Okay. And I had kind of mentioned, you know, well, one of the ways I get clients, in fact, the place I've gotten the majority of my clients from my tax business has been by being on podcasts. So my action item was to reach out to 10 podcasts that week.
Okay.
To ask to be on their show.
Yeah.
And I went out and searched for libertarian podcasts and business podcasts and all these things. And I had like 9 of them that I decided and I couldn't find a 10th. And I'm like, I mean, he'll never have me on, but sure. At least I can say I got my action item done. I'm just going to ask Tom.
All right.
And it was like the most fortuitous thing ever. Like I swear to God, I emailed him and I had his email because he and I had corresponded over something a few years before. He had a legal question.
Uh-huh.
And I had kind of helped him with that, or offered to help him with that at least. But I emailed him and I said, hey, this is what I do. I'd love to be on your show. I gave him some social proof, again, just like I did to ask me on your show. Like, sure. Here's some of the other podcasts I've been on. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not a total loser who's going to, you know, stink up your show. And I swear to God, it was like 40 minutes later, he emailed back like, yeah, I have an opening Tuesday. Can you be on?
Boom.
Like, this was like Sunday.
Yeah.
And like I learned later he had another guest scheduled for that who had canceled, like apparently like right before I had sent him the email.
Okay.
So it was like perfect timing for him, perfect timing for me. And then I'm going, oh, crap. I never actually thought he'd have me on. Like, that's a really big podcast. He's like a really big time guy. And
yeah.
And I still say that's probably one of the two biggest podcasts I've gotten to be on. And I don't want to turn this into the, you know, praise the Tom Woods show.
No, do it.
He's been a great guy. He's been very friendly with me. He sent out an email blast for me the day after tax day this year. Basically, you know, did you not like what you paid in taxes? Well, maybe you should go talk to Matthew.
Right.
And I literally had over 100 people reach out to me from that one email.
Well, I think it's a good place to say go to www.agoristaxadvice.com/O'Leary and you can reach out to Matthew there. That's provided us with that link. And I would say not only there, but you'll get this check, or it's not really a checklist, but it's a document, 12 pages or something, about 60 business expense ideas and some personal deduction ideas also that most of them guaranteed you haven't thought about. Right.
And so
I have,
yeah, I made that list because it's like so many of those things are things that nobody thinks about as something deductible. And it's like, it's amazing. It's both amazing what is deductible and then sometimes what's not deductible.
Right.
Like there's some things that have very particular rules for. Like it's nearly impossible to deduct a cruise as a business expense.
Uh-huh.
Just because there's rules that say it's really hard to deduct a cruise as a business expense. But, you know, there's so many things you can do. And I'll just go into my very favorite way to save money on taxes if you have a business is to hire your kids.
Okay.
Because your kids have their own standard deduction.
You have to be 8 or 9 or something, right?
No.
Oh, no.
You can hire your 6-month-old as a model for your website.
Oh, okay.
I have my own. I mean, I'm still learning about taxes. I signed up for a mentorship program earlier this year. And that mentor, for a conference he did, had his grandkids up on stage with him. The presentation was how to pay your grandkids. And he paid them each $500 for being there. And like, again, one of them was 1 year old. One of them was 4 years old.
Wow.
Now, you have to follow the state laws.
Sure.
Wherever you live. Most states have a lot of exceptions that say if it's a parent, it's fine, but some don't, and some even those exceptions have exceptions. But, you know, it's not hard to find a way to pay your kid $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a year. And again, they're not going to owe any income tax on that at all, and you'll get a write-off on your taxes for what you pay them.
Okay.
And a lot of the times, they're not even going to owe any of the FICA or payroll taxes on their income. If they're under the age of 18, there's an exception where a parent can pay their own child and not pay that 15.3% of FICA or payroll taxes.
Yeah. I first learned about this a couple of weeks ago. There's another member in the school who's a tax advisor, and he had a webinar and I was learning about a lot of the same stuff. He's not an attorney, I don't believe. I could be wrong, but you are an attorney. So what's the difference there for you being an attorney and tax advisor? Not necessarily a tax attorney, but you are an attorney and a tax advisor. How does that help somebody versus just a CPA, for instance? Or
yeah. So I'm going to say something first. So first of all, only certain people can legally sell tax advice.
Okay.
It's highly regulated, and you have to meet one of three requirements, basically. You have to be a CPA.
Okay.
You have to be an attorney, or you have to be something called an enrolled agent.
Got it.
Which is an IRS designation. So anybody else who's selling you tax advice, they're not obeying the law. Now, I don't think that's just the law. I don't care about that. But just if somebody out there is doing that, just when people break the law in one way, maybe they're not honest in other ways and you don't want to do business with them, but maybe you do, because maybe they're a good agorist. With an enrolled agent or a CPA, they are going to not have one advantage that there is to working with an attorney. And that advantage is, with an attorney, you have attorney-client privilege. And attorney-client privilege is the most absolute privilege there is in the law. The only exception to it is if somebody hires an attorney with the intent of using that attorney's services to commit a crime in the future, it doesn't apply, because the attorney is a conspirator.
Right.
So you can't hire me to help you commit tax fraud. Anything else I discuss with my clients or potential clients.
Okay.
Like somebody call me, just, hey, I'm interested in hiring you. It is 100% privileged. Under no circumstances can I tell anybody, can I be forced to tell anybody about it? And that's a key difference, that, again, there is no privilege with the CPA.
Okay.
Well, as you can imagine, me being very agorist and libertarian, a lot of my clients tend to be in the same camp. In fact, that's kind of why I market myself as an agorist.
Sure.
I'm trying to get those sorts of people. And a lot of those people, they maybe want to be a little more aggressive in their taxes. You know, how far can I go in this gray area? Well, if you have that discussion with your CPA and your CPA has notes about it, the IRS is going to get those notes if they audit you.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they charge you with tax evasion or tax fraud. They're not going to get my notes. And you can see how that's a bad thing, right? If the discussion is, well, this is a really, like, if your CPA puts down, client called up, I told him this was a very gray area and he might not be right, like, that's going to be used as evidence against you.
Mm.
But with an attorney, privilege protects that.
Okay.
Now, the downside to privilege is it does limit some of what I can do. Currently, I don't do any taxes for any of my clients.
Uh-huh.
Because that's not legal work, that's accounting work, and the privilege would not apply to that accounting work.
But that's your strategy applies. The tactics employed by the CPA don't necessarily apply. So you would have to farm it out either to the client himself or a CPA or some other tax preparer type person, right?
Well,
the client would do that.
And yeah, there's another loophole, and the loophole is if I create a separate company,
okay,
that separate company can do it, and I will do that someday. I just basically, so many of my clients already have CPAs they like working with to do their taxes.
Right.
It doesn't make sense to go through the rigmarole to create a completely separate entity yet. It might in 2024. I think the way I'm growing it will in 2025.
Uh-huh.
And then just, again, anything we discuss for tax preparation, that's not going to be privileged, versus things we discuss for planning, that is. I'm going to have to make sure people understand what basically who they're talking to.
So prep and plan, prep and planning are different.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. That's the main takeaway there. Now, we talk about all this stuff, and then people are like, oh, I can't do that. I can't hire my kid, or I can't take the such and such deduction or whatever, because I'm going to get audited. What do you say to that?
Usually I say, I don't want you as a client if you're a coward.
Got it. Oh, wow.
Like, now again, like there's being, there's being overly afraid, and then there's being rationally afraid, right?
Okay.
Like, we should be afraid of the IRS because they can do bad things to us.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's irrational to be afraid of the IRS because they can do bad things to you. But on the other hand, there's 350 million of us, and the IRS doesn't have time to audit everybody. So really, it's more don't do things that are going to paint a target on your back, and you're probably going to be fine.
Okay.
You know, it's the same way that, like, you know, I'm not going to insult a TSA agent when I'm late for a flight because I'm going to miss that flight if I do.
Sure.
But on the other hand, you know, I don't spend all my time worrying about them. But the other thing is, like, and this is something I look at is, you know, at some point a fine is the cost you pay for doing something that's not allowed. And sometimes it's just, it's risk versus reward. You know, it's like, if I do this, I'm going to save $500 a year. Now, if the IRS audits me, and if I'm wrong about it, maybe it then costs me $600 a year for every year I did it.
Okay.
But what are the odds that they're going to, A, even look at me, and then B, think I'm doing something wrong? Well, that's a 1% chance. I might as well do it.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Now, if there was a possibility of, oh, and I go to prison for 5 years for doing it, now I'm probably not going to take that risk.
Right.
But most things that people get in trouble with the IRS for are not criminal matters. It's a civil matter. It's 100% about do you owe them money or not? And as much as I hate to say it, the IRS is at least actually pretty good about their job is to collect the right amount of taxes.
Okay.
This is different. As many other tax agencies in the world, their mandate is collect as much as possible.
Would you say that state-run institutions, state revenue departments, are the same way or not?
From what I've heard, California is very much get as much as possible.
Yeah, unfortunately, in California.
Many state institutions are similar, though. They're supposed to collect the correct amount of the tax, which means I have actually seen people who have filled out their taxes wrong, and the IRS looked at it and decided they had done it wrong and they had overpaid, and the IRS just sends them a check. Doesn't happen often, but it does happen.
Right.
So again, like I think of it more like a force of nature.
Okay.
You know, yeah, a lightning bolt could hit you from the middle of nowhere, and an audit could hit you from the middle of nowhere, but you don't, you know, spend all your time worrying about getting hit by lightning because there's other things going on. You know, that said, again, I don't take on clients who are like, oh, I'm not going to pay taxes, or I'm, you know, going to do things that are super, super risky, because I don't want to poke the bear either.
Right.
So it's, you know, I let my clients decide how aggressive they want to be with the gray areas, and I'll give them my advice about how aggressive it is. You know, like I'll pretty much tell someone, okay, this is one end of the range. This is one end of the range. Here's the risk. Now you make a decision, because it's not my job to tell you how aggressive to be. It's my job to give my clients the information they need so they can make an informed decision. You know, in that respect, it's not much different than medicine, right? Like a good doctor doesn't say we're going to do this procedure. A good doctor says, okay, here's the diagnosis. Here are the options. Here's my recommendation. Here are the risks of my recommendation. Here are the alternatives. Here are why I don't think those are as good. And now you get to make a decision.
We're finding there's not as many good doctors after 2020 as we thought there might have been. So we got a lot of people like you in the tax world that are providing that role or filling that gap, sounds like to me.
No, and very few tax people actually do what I do.
Okay.
You know, the vast majority of CPAs are CPAs because they like basically doing the math, doing the tax returns, doing the accounting.
Yeah.
Frankly, the other reason I don't have a company doing that yet is that's not fun for me. Like, I don't hate it. I don't mind doing the math, but it's not fun. Whereas the tax planning, it's a puzzle. And it's like the most complicated puzzle in the world. And even if it's really similar for most people, every puzzle is just a little bit different. And so I'm always looking for, oh, there's that piece and there's that piece, and I can put those together here. And so it is really, at some point, it's a game for me.
Okay.
You know, it's a serious game, but it's a game, and it's something that's just, again, it's kind of fun for me just to like, man, I pulled out this thing that only applies to 0.5% of people, but this client's going to save $1,000 because I knew this and told him to do this. I love when that happens.
Yeah. And then, and they don't owe you necessarily any more than they would, right? I mean, are you doing it on a fee basis or percentage, or how they save, or can you negotiate any contract you want?
So I can, as an attorney, my fee has to be a reasonable fee. Now, who determines that? The vast majority of my clients, I take for a flat fee for a year of the engagement.
Okay.
So it's like, I'll start with them and I'll basically say, hey, like, we'll have a long talk. I'll dig into the nitty gritty of their business. Sometimes that's a 30-minute talk. Sometimes that's an hour and a half talk.
Okay.
I'll then go and I'll write a plan. Okay. Do the following things in your business. Think about the following things in your business. Then we'll have another talk or two talks where I explain the plan to them and make sure they understand it. And then I kind of switch into more of a coaching role where as they have questions, they can contact me and get answers and not pay anything extra.
Okay.
I do take people on an hourly basis. I don't like doing it because A, I don't like keeping track of my time, but B, it's a bad incentive. And in fact, one of my very first clients was paying me by the hour and so didn't contact me before they did something. That phone call would have been maybe $100 and they did something wrong and it cost them thousands of dollars. I mean, literally like thousands and thousands of dollars.
Okay.
And so I don't want there to be a time when my clients are afraid to contact me because I'm going to charge them and then do something ignorant.
Right.
Because that's what it is. It's not stupidity. It's most people are ignorant of what the tax code really is.
Sure.
And so really kind of what I like to say is I give people a fish. Here's your plan. But then I teach them to fish. I start teaching them the rules and how they apply to their business. Because the other thing is I'm never going to understand my client's business as well as they do. So I need them to help me find things to save money on. By, you know, coming to me and saying, hey, I just had this come up, or hey, I'm planning on doing this. Uh-huh. What's the best way to do this in my business tax-wise?
Right. Yeah. And you said you don't like keeping track of time necessarily, but you also recommend, like you said, you mentioned earlier about saving money by employing your children if you have them, but it's to keep records. And that is a pain in the neck for maybe a lower than the neck for a lot of folks.
Yeah. Record keeping is one of the hardest parts for anybody trying to make sure they're maximizing their tax savings. Uh-huh. Because one of the tests to determine if something is a deductible business expense or not is what records do you have to support it? Mm. So for example, the IRS does not accept a credit card statement as evidence of an expense. They want the actual receipts. Now, the IRS understands some people lose receipts some of the time. And so if you have, you know, three meals out, that's $50 total that you can't find the receipts for, the IRS is usually not going to give you a hard time over that. But if it's a $400 meal, they're going to want to see a receipt. Or if they, again, you don't send that to them with a tax return, but if they ask for the receipts and you don't have it, they're not going to allow it.
Got it.
Other types of records that can really matter are, you know, again, I love doing business meals with people. And, you know, my wife is a co-owner in our real estate business. So we go out to lunch or dinner on a somewhat regular basis and make it a business meeting. Well, I send an email to her after those meetings. Hey, this is what we talked about at our business meeting.
Minutes.
Just so I have the record to prove that we actually talked about business.
Okay.
Because the gold standard is a contemporaneous record. Like something you do that day or the next day is going to be way better than something you do a month later.
Okay.
And with metadata, the IRS can tell when you created a file.
Uh-huh.
So don't lie about that sort of stuff.
Got it.
But yeah, record keeping is it's the bane of most small business people's existence. I mean, I'm not great at it. One of my favorite tricks, though, is like you don't actually need the physical receipt. A digital copy is good enough.
Okay.
So as what I do with most of my receipts, I just take a photo of it.
All right. So, but say I'm going to like one of those Clover machines, those new Clover machines where you stick your card in. Do you want a receipt with that? Or you want to email to you? What would you say there? Do you want them having your email? Is that a bigger thing? Or just say, give me the paper? Or like if it's a cup of coffee, don't worry about it. But if you go to get like 20 cups of coffee in a year, you can save yourself theoretically a few more bucks. Is that?
Yeah. I typically don't bother saying any receipts less than $5.
Okay.
Because it takes me a minute or two to process a receipt.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how big it is. It takes about the same amount of time. And just, I think my time is more valuable than that.
Yeah. Cost benefit.
Now, if there were an easier way to do it, like, I don't know if you have Panera near you, but there's one by me.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can buy through their app and then the record of the app suffice as evidence.
Okay.
So there you don't need to keep the one receipt. You can instead just, you know, at the end of, you know, as long as you know what each meal is for and can prove it's business related, you could just like do the total thing as one document.
I see.
But I like having digital records just because receipts get lost, they wear, they fade away. But again, what I'll usually do with the receipt I want to keep, I'll take my phone out, I'll take a picture of it, I'll email it to myself so it's in my email and it's in the cloud. And then any emails that I get that are a business expense, whether it's for myself, whether it's, you know, my web hosting fee, whatever, I just mark it with a label.
Sure.
And then once a month, in my case, it's usually the first Saturday of every month, I sit down. Well, actually, now my daughter sits down because she's my bookkeeper now.
Got it.
Because hire your kids.
Yeah.
But before this year, I would sit down and do it starting a few months ago. About once a month, she sits down and she processes all those receipts and gets them all categorized. And that's how I do it.
Right on. All right. Yeah. And that, I mean, this is all great stuff. And like I said, go to www.eggerstaxadvice.com/O'Leary and you can find more of this. And then that'll sign you up for your weekly newsletter and, you know, potentially what, 15-minute consult if you want to sign up for that. Yeah. So for
that website, no apostrophe in O'Leary.
Correct. So just I mean, if you've ever seen the way my name is spelled in the digital realm, I mean, you get all sorts of wacky characters if you try to put some places, if you try and put apostrophes. But yeah, O-L-E-A-R-Y. There you go. So you had a podcast. Do you still have the podcast? It depends.
Sort of.
Okay.
I started that and basically I realized that I needed to put more focus into my tax business and really, you know, I was always professional about the work. I was not running the marketing as a business. I was doing it much more haphazardly.
Okay.
And so I decided, you know what, I'm going to focus on the one thing that really matters right now. And then I'll go back to the other thing I want to be doing later.
Right.
So I've kept the podcast up because my goal is probably January to restart it.
Okay. And I like the format from what I've heard. We're about 4 or 5 episodes so far, and it's just 20 minutes here, 20 minutes there. I started doing that a little bit myself outside of the, you know, the long form interviews, and you know, you just got to get your philosophy out there. So then that is a little bit of marketing for you, so you know who you're getting. And you spread the word. You just spread the word, which is like possibly even better for people like us, that the more people that, like I say, the more you think about my ideas, the more you'll agree.
Yeah. And also it was kind of a way for me to talk to some of my friends about this stuff in a way they might listen to it, whereas they wouldn't if I was like having a discussion with them individually.
Right. And it's almost the last thing you want to do with your buddies to sit down and talk about work. All right. You know, like it gets a little tedious with some folks, and some guys, you know, will love to talk about it, but yeah, I totally understand. It's a good medium. And then you get to broadcast it out. And like, if you don't like today, in today's world, we're kind of touching a lot of people, but we're not in constant contact with that core group a lot. So, yeah. So best of luck with that podcast. I hope to hear more of it because I enjoyed what I hear. And like I said, agristaxadvice.com/O'Leary, no apostrophe, and get Matthew's free report, 60 business expense ideas and a few personal deductions as well. And we mentioned the great Tom Woods earlier. And if you have any questions on Tom Woods' School of Life, you can reach out to me or just go to briandealeary.com/TSOL, which stands for Tom's School of Life. And we got more information there for you. Any last words, Matthew, before we bid adieu?
Well, just I'll hype Tom one more time because when I joined his program, I did it as a business expense.
Okay. Well done.
So, you know, and when I go, have gone to his house for the things he's done for supporting listeners, I paid for that as a business expense. That's, you know, part of me marketing and meeting my potential clients.
It sure is.
So just another reason to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I look forward to getting to know you a lot more, a lot better in the next few weeks and months. And it's been a pleasure having you on the program. And we'll send everybody your way. Once again, agristaxadvice.com/O'Leary. And thanks again, Matthew.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
You bet. For more of our podcasts, head on over to briandealeary.com. And while you're over there, sign up for our email list. We'll send you daily emails. You can also find the link for our Substack page and various other resource pages we have. And that's at briandealeary.com.